as long as I can remember, I have been in love with love. And I would find myself talking to friends about their relationships for hours on end and not even noticing how much time had gone by. So I decided to start charging them for this. I went and I got a PhD in this stuff, and now it's my job. And I wanted to talk to you all today about a few myths in the world of dating and marriage. So some of what I say might not be very popular, too bad. hopefully it'll resonate with some of you and make some changes if necessary. Myth number one, love at first sight. We all love this idea, right? It's just exciting. It makes us feel hopeful. It's a great idea. But, there's always a but. Researchers at Harvard have found that when a person is first falling in love, their brain is releasing all sorts of feel-good chemicals that are addicting. You feel attachment, you feel warmth, you feel closeness, you even feel a drive for monogamy. But what they've also found is that as you're falling in love, something else is going on that we don't really like to talk about. As you're falling in love, the part of your brain that's in charge of critical thinking and rational thought is completely dormant. It's asleep. This is why when we see friends around us, never us, but when we see friends around us making really poor choices in who they date, we wonder what they're thinking and what could possibly be going through their minds. The truth is they're just not thinking. This is the first stage of love. And it's not bad to crave this feeling or to want this feeling, but where we go wrong is when we expect to feel it right away. And if we don't feel it right away, we think that he or she isn't the one. This initial feeling of love, by the way, this like goo goo gaga, like, oh my God, everything is awesome and I'm so happy that I need to jump. There's no link between this and success later on, P.S. No link. So just put that in your back pocket. And the thing is that when we seek to find this feeling in the beginning, what we're actually doing is we're seeking a feeling that by definition is shutting off a part of our brain that makes us think critically. When we are seeking out love at first sight, or we're jumping from relationship to relationship because this high is addicting, and it actually is an addiction for a lot of people, when we jump from relationship to relationship, we're seeking a feeling that is actually to our detriment. It's actually causing us to not think clearly. We only hear the success stories of love at first sight, right? We're always around that really sappy couple who's like, oh my God, I just knew. I saw her across the crowded room and I just knew. Our hands touched and love at first sight. Nobody ever says, I just knew and boy was I dead wrong. Nobody ever says that. You don't hear those stories of I just knew and I was an idiot. We only hear the success stories or the currently successful stories. Still to be determined. But what happens is it creates a confirmation bias. We think that love at first sight is a real thing, so we look for stories that support this. And we'll be like, well, so-and-so fell in love at first sight, and this couple just knew when they first met. So all of these points, all of these stories reinforce our belief that this is how it should be. But we don't pay attention to the stories of any other way that it's happened. Maybe it's somebody that you knew for a long time, or maybe it's somebody that initially you weren't so attracted to and later on it grew, or maybe it's someone who you just didn't see. We just don't talk about it. It's always, I just knew. The Baha'i writings talk about love. There's a lot of writings about love. Abdu'l-Bahá says, "Today you will see two souls apparently in close friendship. Tomorrow all this may be changed. When that which has caused this love to exist passes, the love passes also. This is not in reality love." When I read this, it makes me think that maybe what we're seeking is fascination. Love doesn't happen in a glance. I'm sorry to get scientific on you guys. It doesn't happen in a glance at all. It takes time. Maybe it should be called being really, really, really hopeful at first sight. But love takes time to build. It takes becoming thoroughly acquainted with the other person. It takes conscious effort. It takes a lot. It takes vulnerability. Big time, big one, big. So it's not love at first sight. It's fascination. Maybe you get lucky and it actually ends up being the right thing. But a lot of times it doesn't. And it's important to pay attention to that too. Second myth. The more experience you have before marriage, the better. The more you date, the more you find out what you want. Not true. I personally haven't, I don't think I've ever talked to anybody who was like, you know what, I just dated hundreds of people and then I figured it out. I've never heard that. How do we know? Through experience. And through knowing that there isn't one person who has everything packaged up. But we'll get to that a little bit later. So the more experience you have, the better. This is a really, really dangerous myth. And it's one that's actually very rampant in our culture today. Date around, take your time, don't get married right away, see what's out there. We've all heard this. I'm not saying that that you should, you know, just marry the very first person that you meet. But this idea that you need experience to know what works for you is a fallacy. Our culture teaches us that the more options we have, the better. That's why websites like Match and eHarmony or apps like Tinder, Bumble, I can't even keep up anymore. That's why these things are so popular. Because if you find someone who's maybe a couple inches too short, a couple pounds too heavy, maybe they like a team that rivals yours, something about them, maybe they got a mole you don't really like, you can just swipe left or right, I don't know, left. Because there's 200-300 other people right behind that will fit you better, or so you think. Psychologist Dr. Schwartz did his research on the paradox of choice. And what he found is that more is not better. He found that actually the cultures where people have an abundance of choice and an abundance of options, whether it's salad dressing or gene types or Jell-O. The cultures that have the most options and the most choice, those people are the most depressed and report the lowest satisfaction of their life, lowest life quality. And the cultures that have fewer choices have the happiest people, the most content people. So more is not better. And he found choice actually leads to three pretty dangerous outcomes. Number one, loss of choice leads to paralysis. When you have a lot of things to choose from, suddenly you just can't choose anymore. Number two, even if you're able to overcome this paralysis, you still end up less satisfied than if you had had fewer options. We keep thinking, ah, oh, I woulda, coulda, shoulda, ah, oh, I picked wrong. I should have swiped the other way. Third outcome of too many choices is higher expectations. The more choices you have, the more expectations you have of the person that you finally pick. So I was talking with a friend of mine about this, and he said it's like going to In-N-Out versus Cheesecake Factory. You go to In-N-Out, and they're like, do you want a burger or not? Why are you wasting my time? Maybe I'll give you a grilled cheese, but move on. You go to Cheesecake Factory, and they give you a menu 83 pages thick. It takes 5 minutes just to get to the, like, main course. And after a while, you're so tired of looking through this menu that eventually you're like, I don't know, just give me the scampi. I don't know. And then when you get the scampi, you're like, eh, it was all right. Yours looks better. You all can relate to this. And none of you go through this at In-N-Out. You go to In-N-Out, you get your burger, and your biggest decision is whether or not you should get animal-style fries. It's so much easier. Baha'u'llah says, Baha'u'llah is the prophet founder of the Baha'i faith. He says, put away all covetousness and seek contentment. For the covetous has ever been deprived, and the contented has ever been loved and praised. Covetousness is just a really fancy word for greed. I'm not trying to say, don't look a little bit. But we need to find the balance between looking and becoming greedy. I would suggest that when we find someone who's great, don't think that you're just gonna double down and find something greater. Find someone great and invest in it and make it the greatest thing for you. It's like the cliche says, the grass isn't greener on the other side, it's greener where you water it. I can't take credit for it. No, no, no. I'm actually now embarrassed to admit that I first heard it in a Justin Bieber song. But it's a real quote, I promise. I looked it up. Myth number three, it shouldn't be hard. How many of you guys have heard this? When you've had a difficult time, you're going through a rough patch in your relationship, and you confide in somebody, and they are just like, ah, oh, it just shouldn't be hard. You really, life's supposed to be easy. What? Life is supposed to be easy? That's the first for me. We live at a time where we're constantly trading in and trading up. We might have a great iPhone, but when the next one comes out, you bet you're in line waiting for that one, even if your phone's great. We want the newer car model. We want the newest fashion trends, whatever. And I fear that this idea of wanting and also not wanting to struggle too much is causing us to walk away whenever there's the first bump in the road, because it shouldn't be hard. And so because we believe in this idea that it shouldn't be hard, we now avoid conflict. That's the other thing that we do, is when we have friction in our relationship, we don't want to talk about it because we don't want to rock the boat, right? Dr. John Gottman is a world-renowned couples therapist who has spent decades studying couples. This man's work is unbelievable. One of the things that he's found is that when you avoid conflict in order to keep the peace, you're actually, in the long run, harming your relationship. So when we hold back, when we hold things in, we're actually depriving our partner of showing us that they're capable of weathering the storm. So we might think we're keeping the peace, but we're actually creating distance. So you might not be fighting. It might feel peaceful, but in that peace is a growing distance. The good news is that it doesn't matter if you have conflict or even how much of it you have. That doesn't matter. What matters is how you handle it, how you address it. Abdu'l-Bahá says that the shining spark of truth cometh forth only after the clash of differing opinions. He doesn't say, don't have differing opinions. He doesn't say, don't clash. He's actually saying that that's how you find truth. Now, it does matter how you engage in conflict. You shouldn't scream. There are a lot of don'ts. But the healthiest approach, which is reflected in the Baha'i writings and in Gottman's research, is to actually remain as dispassionate as possible when you're talking about something tricky, Try to take your emotion out of it and just focus on the issue at hand. The next myth, the pre-marriage trial run. This is one that's very much pushed in our society. Society tells us before you get married, test it out, see how compatible you are, and then decide to get married. And the two ways that we test it out is through sex and through moving in together. One of the things that people say a lot is you gotta have sex with each other to see if you're compatible. We all hear this. The thing is that sexual compatibility is created. It's not discovered. It's not something that you unearth and you're like, oh my God, we're so compatible. No, sexual compatibility is the result of a healthy relationship. So even in the beginning, if you have mind-blasting sex, it is not a predictor of how your sex life is gonna be later. Because remember, you're on a chemical high and your brain is dead. And later on, when reality sets in, because by the way, that chemical high only lasts between 6 months to 2 years. It doesn't mean it's downhill from there. That's my next topic. Your closeness to one another is what determines how sexually compatible you are. In addition to this, researchers at the University of Virginia have found that the more sexual partners you have before marriage, the higher the likelihood of infidelity. They are not the first researchers to find this. This has been found in study after study after study. I'm not saying this to make anybody feel guilty about any choices that they've made, but I am putting it out there for you to think about for future choices that you might make. Second trial run that we have is through moving in together. This is a really big one. Our society is always talking about how you gotta know if you can live together before you get married. The thing is that living together before marriage actually is one of the worst things that you can do. Researchers at Rutgers University did a very comprehensive review of all the data out there about this, and they found three pretty interesting points. Number one, they found that couples who live together before marriage have a higher likelihood of divorce, not success. You move in together before marriage, higher chance of divorce. Again, I'm not saying this to freak people out. Well, no, I do want to freak you out. But I'm not saying it to judge at all. I'm not trying to judge. I'm only presenting the research to you, and you can do with it what you want. So, number one, people who live together before marriage have a higher likelihood of divorce. Number two, people who live together before marriage are more likely to experience violence, both from their partner and towards children if they're around. Physical and sexual violence. Number three, people who live together but are not married have lower rates of happiness than people who are married and living together. So what do we do? If we can't go on this trial run the way that society tells us to, what do we do? Abdu'l-Bahá says to exercise the utmost care to become thoroughly acquainted with the character of the other. We live in a culture where we think Netflix and chill is how you get to know someone. Or even go to dinner. Why? So you can like interrogate one another and like you're really gonna give honest answers about yourself and be like, yeah, I'm secretly kind of nuts, but pass the bread. Nobody says that. Nobody says that. Instead, I would suggest that we need to take an intentional approach. How do we do that? The best way that you can get to know someone is to see them when they're really stressed out. Because stress is what breaks a marriage, not the happy times. That's why most couples that are on The Bachelor don't make it. I've heard, I don't know, I don't really watch it. But when you only seek out the warm, fuzzy times, you're only seeing them in their warm, fuzzy moments. And nobody divorces over the warm fuzzies. They divorce because they couldn't cope with stress. So what I would suggest is being more intentional in how you get to know somebody. Maybe go on a cross-country road trip where you're forced to sit in a car with them for hours on end. See how that goes. Maybe go to a country where you don't speak the language and see how you travel together. Or just babysit your friend's really hyper toddler for a few days while they're out of town. Then you get to see them when they're stressed out and how they are around kids. But I would argue that we just need to be more intentional in how we get to know someone. It doesn't work through interrogation. It doesn't work through coexisting on a couch or in a movie theater. It works when you actually see them at their worst. I have a friend who always says, she and her husband are very happily married, and they always say, you gotta find somebody whose crazy doesn't drive you crazy, and your crazies can coexist. The final myth, myth number five, is that marriage sucks the life out of you. In our culture, we are inundated with messages about how tedious marriage is. We refer to it as the ball and chain. We talk about it as settling down. Get everything out of your system before you settle down. Sitcoms revolve around couples who can't stand to be around each other. They're constantly rolling their eyes at how stupid their partner is. They're constantly scoffing at the idea of having sex together. They're just over it. And this is what popular culture would have us believe about marriage. We aren't taught by our culture to look forward to it, to be excited about it. We're taught to dread it. But the research tells us differently. Researchers at the University of Missouri and the University of Virginia have found that married people are the happiest. Happier than single people, happier than widows, and happier than divorced people. They're the happiest, and they are also the most physically and emotionally healthy, and they have the lowest likelihood of committing suicide. And they've also found that in the experiment, they have you hooked up, and they tell you that you're about to receive electric shock. But when you're happily married and your partner is next to you holding your hand, your brain registers that pain way, way better when you're happily married and holding their hand than if you're actually holding the hand of someone that you're not happily married to. So it functions as a painkiller. Baha'u'llah says, "You must irrigate continually the tree of your union with the water of love and affection, so that it may remain green and verdant throughout all the seasons." I love this quote because it's telling us that marriage has the power to heal, not just ourselves as individuals, but it has the power to heal the nations. Do you think that it's a coincidence that as our world seems to be falling apart, the institution of marriage is also falling apart? They're connected. It's the nucleus of our society. What we have to do in order to ensure the happiness is to constantly tend to this union. It's easy to think that once you're married, you're coasting, that you did all the hard work. But really, you can't go on cruise control when you're married. That's when the work begins. And you have to constantly irrigate your relationship for it to flourish in the way that you want. You have to intentionally connect with your spouse. Intentionally be vulnerable. Have conversations that go deeper than just who's going to get the kids from school. You have to intentionally have sex. This is not a joke. You have to make time for it. Couples who make time for sex, even when they're exhausted, not in the greatest space, but they make time for it, report higher levels of happiness afterwards and more feelings of fondness and bonding with their partners. I know that I've said a lot of things today that are uncomfortable, they might rattle you a little bit. They're definitely challenging us and challenging what common society would have us believe. But I would invite you to consider what you could do differently. What could you be doing differently so that you can get what it is that you're actually seeking? Could you change your idea of what love actually is? Could you change the story of how it's supposed to look? Can you maybe find a balance between searching for a great fit and searching for better and better and better? Because remember, being greedy makes you feel deprived. And being content actually leads to true happiness. So it takes courage to go against what society is telling us to do. But our society isn't happy. So I'm not sure that we really should be taking society's advice. So I would encourage you to find the courage that it takes to do it differently, because that courage is more than likely exactly what's gonna bring you what you've been waiting for the whole time. Thank you.